What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either.
Really.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode, and also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Hi, friends.
Hello. Happy Monday. I am so thrilled for this conversation. I absolutely devoured past tense and immediately started hatching this plan to try and get connected to you because I really wanted to have you on the podcast, having completely forgotten that we had met and that you had given me your previous comics, which is a whole other conversation about my memory and face blindness. But needless to say, I am just so excited to have you on here reading this book. There was so many things I was trying to like sum it up in like one or two, it feels impossible. But one of the biggest thing was that was so validating was seeing a peek into your experience of therapy. I've been in therapy for a really long time. IFS, internal family systems, has been really important to me in my work. But there's something about how private and insular it is that you kind of wonder if it's real. And reading this and like being able to see your actual experience. And I was like, oh, those are words that my therapist says to me, you visualizing like going back and holding your younger self. And I was like, oh, so the thing that I did, that wasn't an anomaly. Like that was real. That was a real experience. And so that's one of the like overarching, like warm, big hugs that I'm taking away from this. So.
Oh, thank you, Caitlin. That is such beautiful connection and feedback. It really means a lot to me. And you know, part of the reason for making this book was that I'm British and I don't come from a culture where society is normal or accepted or talked about or encouraged. And so when I did finally go to therapy in America at the age of 41, it had all these gifts for me that all these experiences that and this space that would allow me to process everything I carried. And I had no idea that therapy would be so liberating. So there's like a part of me that's like, I need to tell people about this because nobody knows. And of course, other people do know because they go through this as well. And therapists hold this space for people every day. So in a way, you know, I wanted to get some stealth therapy out there into the world, but also to sort of write this love letter to this process that was so amazing and powerful for me that was a surprise because I was not expecting it to help in the way it did.
And I think there is so much more acceptance in the States, but it still is so taboo.
And generational.
Yeah. Oh my God.
My parents and in-laws are not about to jump on any therapy trains. Yeah. It's interesting the narratives that different generations seem to have about it. Similarly, Sasha, Caitlin had been talking about past tense, just like gushing for a couple of weeks before I was like, I need to buy this book. And came while I was making dinner and I just started flipping through it. And then I was like, oh no, I can't do anything else tonight. I'm in it. And I'm wondering if we could like give our listeners just like a little tiny little preview hook for it so they know what book we're talking about. I'm assuming that you've had to give, I don't know what they call them, like elevator pitches of this book or like summary. Like what, how do we describe it? There's so much here. It's so rich. It's so full. How do you describe it to people?
Sure. So it's a book about experiencing very acute anxiety in midlife. So I turned 40 and just all of a sudden was just battling like constant chronic anxiety and fearful about everything and hypervigilant about everything. And I finally sought help and ended up in therapy. And what happened was I ended up unfolding my childhood story and realizing how my very disrupted childhood had given birth to a lot of parts of me, coping strategies that were dealing with life in a way that was no longer working. You know, like coping strategies you take on as a teenager are not really the best thing to help you deal with life when you're 40 and you have a kid. And so I had to basically relearn a whole new way that A, my childhood mattered and that my family story did matter and was important and wasn't something that I just left behind me. But there was actually, you know, emotional pain that I needed to work through. And I found self-compassion on that journey and it transformed everything. So in a nutshell, it's a 3-year therapy journey from beginning to end. And it's the family story like woven into it. So I go back and forth between the family story and the healing that I found in therapy.
And it's a graphic memoir. So part of the story is the text, but the illustrations are very rich with like a whole other layer of storytelling I found in my experience of the book. Like there's multiple modes of storytelling happening in the pages.
Oh, thank you. I mean, one of the therapy models I used with my therapist was internal family systems, or IFS. And the great thing about that is, as a cartoonist, you get to draw all the parts of yourself. So it's not just you and your therapist like talking heads. It's like all the parts of me coming out. And so that was like a real gift to draw. And I honestly don't think this book could have been done in any other way. I don't think I could have done it in prose, you know, or as a documentary. It had to be a graphic memoir.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way that I was struck by how you like told the story of your childhood and then you like told it again through the lens of therapy. And there was so much complexity and so much nuance given to the story. It wasn't like, oh, I went to therapy and everything's forgiven and healed. It was like, it almost got messier, but richer. And that part was being able to like intimately, literally on the page, see your story told from two different vantage points or like experiences or ways that you're contextualizing it. Of course, in real life, it's like probably a lot, I know from my life, it's a lot messier than like just a neat and tidy 3-year book, but it felt really useful to be able to hold these tangibly in my hands and be like, this is real and happened. And this other new way of seeing and feeling about it is also real. And that was just like brilliant. Brilliantly done in the book, and also just like that is the work.
Yeah, thank you. And that is such an interesting take because I feel like you can go through life with a story that you're telling yourself. And I very much went into therapy with a story that I was telling myself. Like, I had this very difficult childhood, but it didn't matter. I'm in America now. I'm validated by this awesome person that I'm married to, and the past is behind me and it's not important. And in therapy, it was like, oh no, this all mattered. It was important. And it was, you know, you can get past something without actually doing the work, or you can actually like do the work. And it's not fun. It's really messy and painful. And it seems to go on forever. And there was a point in my therapy where I'm like, why did I even do this? Like, I was pretty much okay. I mean, I had acne and I was constantly anxious and I was hypervigilant and not enjoying my life. But right now I'm just like a hot jellyfish mess, you know. But that messy middle was so important. It was like a stage, you know, a stage I had to go through. And yeah, it was painful, but there is another side. And that's also what I'm trying to show in the book, is that you can do this work on yourself and there is another place you can get to. And there are great tools that you can learn in therapy, because, you know, life is never going to be all sunshine, roses and rainbows afterwards. I mean, you're still going to deal with the hard stuff of life. But now after therapy, I've got like so many more tools and I've got this core of like self-compassion and knowing how to be there for myself. So it's like, yeah, life is still going to be hard, but I'm like a different version of myself who's like equipped to cope with it now, you know, if that makes sense.
Can I just do a little popcorn question session?
Of course. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, this is fun.
Okay, so another thing that I was really struck by was how you were like writing and reflecting so carefully after each session. Did you have a framework for that? I think the way that you have documented and told this story, I've been in therapy for years and years and years, and I come through phases of documenting or not, but it felt like you are so intentional and like clear focused on like what you were doing in therapy and then like how you were documenting it. And I'm just curious, if what was your like framework after a session for how you documented?
Yeah, sure. So I was keeping a sketchbook diary at the time. So I would have like a little hardback sketchbook that would go everywhere with me. And I would, you know, if I had a spare moment, I would like do a little doodle of, you know, wherever I was. And so that became, because I don't drive, I would get the Metrolink into Clayton to go to therapy. And I would sit at the Metrolink station afterwards. And I would usually have about 15 minutes to wait before the train came. Then I would have a train journey. And then I would have a bus ride. And so I had this time after the therapy sessions to actually kind of chronicle what had kind of come up for me. And so it just became part of my sketchbook diary. And it wasn't the only thing I was drawing, but it was this constant and it became this kind of habit and this routine. So yeah, that's the quick answer to that. And that became the foundation for the online therapy comics I made. Because, you know, I ended up after 3 years with all these sketchbooks full of little therapy session vignettes and all the stuff that had come up for me. And it also became like a really useful way of recording like what happened, because I'm kind of, you know, I grew up in a poor family and I'm kind of, I worry about money like all the time. I just can't get over that little mindset. And so it was like, I'm going to get my money's worth out of therapy because it's expensive. And so, yeah, just writing down all the pearls of wisdom and everything I could use, that became, you know, like a real function of the sketchbook as well.
Yeah, I love that. I love how the public transit like built in a piece of time, that like pocket there, but the intentionality, like it's not, you're not, therapy is not just an hour a week or every other week in your therapist's office. It's like the things you do before and after and how you integrate that into your life. And I just love the way that that was visualized in here.
And I think also because I'm not, you know, I'm not American. I don't come from a culture where therapy is kind of normal. For me, this was like an abnormal thing to do. It was like a difficult thing for me to do. So I'm like, well, I'm going to, you know, and plus the first couple of therapy sessions were actually way better and way more useful than I hoped. And there came a point where I'm like, you know, this is really worth getting into and getting over it. It was like a moment in therapy where my therapist kind of called me out on something and he kind of pointed out to me how I'd not been empathetic. And it was like, ow, like, oh God, that hurts. Like, that hurts my feelings that he thinks I'm not empathetic. And the impulse was there to like justify myself. Well, you know, there's a reason for that. And, but then when I kind of like sat with my sketchbook afterwards, it was like, oh, this is why therapy is important, because my therapist will tell me difficult things that I could sit down with a friend and they wouldn't tell me to my face, girl, you're not being empathetic. You know, you're kind of being cruel. And it was like, oh, this is valuable. Like, he will give me that feedback that no one else will give me, you know, and that's hard, but it was also, it was revolutionary. It felt like a moment of like, okay, this can change things. So,
Caitlin, I don't want to cut off your peppered questions. I have a bunch of questions too, but I want, oh, okay. I, one of the things I also really appreciated, that like lifting the veil, the curtain on like what this relationship was like and how you made decisions, because I was in therapy for maybe like 6 years with one therapist. There's so many decisions to make about when you feel like you're quote unquote done, or like switching therapists, or like how I'm interested in how you, especially that done, I'm doing massive air quotes around that word, that done piece. How do you think about when you feel like I have had enough therapy and now I can fly out with my little fledgling wings into the world and handle some of these things on my own? And, or how do you know when it's time to go back? Like, how do you think about those decisions? Especially in, like that price tag that we've already talked about attached to therapy. Even in the book, you talk about switching therapists. It's like, it was so interesting to me to like watch how you thought about that, what it was like, how, what you even said to your current therapist, like how you handled that was all very, I felt like I was soaking up a lot of just like learning about how to be an adult in therapy through that. Yeah. How do you think about the being done or starting again or piece of therapy?
I keep harking back to the fact that I'm British, but also, you know, because I don't come from a culture where we do this, I don't really have the norms and the rules and like the expectations of therapy and how you behave in therapy and stuff like that. That wasn't something I inherited. So I was kind of new to it in a way, you know, like a tourist or something. It's like, oh, I'm going to explore this and I'm going to stay here for a while and then I'm going to move on and see a different place. Part of it is that I was really lucky. I mean, I have two really amazing therapists and I kind of struck gold like from the start. And so I never had to kind of go through having a crappy therapist and figuring it out that way. I was really lucky. So let me say that for starters. And in the book, what I do is I start off seeing a male therapist who I find because of an acupuncturist who's treating my acne. My acupuncturist makes the connection that this is an emotional issue and I can't really help you any further and therapy would be a good idea. And that was kind of insulting. Like, he thinks I need therapy. But anyway, he recommended somebody and that was my very first therapist. And it was a male. And from the get-go, I didn't really feel comfortable about having a male therapist, but I thought I'd give it a go. And he was fantastic. And there reached a point in my therapy where I discovered internal family systems, IFS. And I was like, I want to do this. This is the model for me. I want to explore and I want to get into it. And yet he and I were in a pattern of just showing up and doing talk therapy. And sometimes he would talk about parts, but it wasn't like we would go there and do IFS from the get-go. So I was feeling kind of like, you know, like this isn't what I want anymore. Like maybe I've outgrown it. And so I found a female therapist who was specialist in IFS. And I kind of went to her and said, look, this is what I want. And the reason I thought to do that was because I was reading a yoga book by a British woman, and she was talking about having two gurus, which you're not meant to do. And she kind of kept it secret because it's, you know, one guru was female and she got all this like, you know, like body connection and felt amazing. And the other one had all this like philosophy and he was great. And so she used to sneak around like, and she used to like go from one like yoga studio to another and just like not tell the other one. I was like, oh, so it's possible to maybe do that with therapy too. So that's where I got the idea from that. But I actually agonized over the decision to kind of switch therapists, and I researched it a lot. And, you know, all the advice was like, just be upfront, like therapists can handle it. They're trained to deal with feedback. And that absolutely was the case. And so when I did switch therapists to work with a female for 9 months, which felt very symbolic, and it wasn't, I didn't set out to just do 9 months of therapy with this woman, but it did feel a little bit like a rebirth in a way. When I went back to my male therapist, because he was such a great family counselor and knew my back history and could help me with very specific new goals that I had for therapy, which was like, how do I deal with the difficult people in my life, right? When I went back to him, the first thing he said to me was like, a whole new person sits before me. Why the hell are you here? And he would continue to say that to me towards the end of therapy, like, you know, you don't need to be here anymore, Sasha. I think you've got this. And I'm like, well, let's just. And then when the pandemic happened and I quit my job, it's like financially I had to kind of quit. But I was ready. Like, I maybe didn't want to take the training wheels off, but my therapist encouraged me. So, I mean, I think that's another good sign of a therapist, like one who is willing to tell you, like, we've reached a good point here. You know, my door's always open to you, but you can, you know, you can stop if you want.
Wow. So you got affirmation. Maybe that's what I still need to look out for. I mean, I never got the affirmation that like you're done.
But it can be a conversation, you know? I mean, you can pick difficult conversations with your therapist and choose to have them. And the enlightening. I mean, I remember when I was seeing my female therapist, she always saw me as a mom and like a woman, but she didn't necessarily see me as an artist. Like, she never really kind of connected that cartoonist part of me, which is such a big part of me, right? And I remember one time she really triggered me by just kind of like dismissing something I'd said about my creative life. And I stewed about it. And I was like, why did I ever come to her? Like, my old therapist like understood me as an artist and all that. And so I was stewing and I was like, I should just talk to her about it. And I talked to her about it. And it was like one of the best conversations we ever had. That's not in the book, but it was like a really important part of like, oh, I can be a self-advocate, you know? And therapy actually gave me the tools to be a self-advocate. And so even when it comes to questioning therapy, like, okay, yeah, I'm the boss here. I'm paying for this. You know, I can sort of pick and choose in a way. And if something's not working, I can speak for that too.
My face, I'm smiling so big and I feel silly, but it's like, oh yeah, you could just say that. You could just ask. Why is that so revelatory for me?
We can say hard things in therapy. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the point, right? That's what you're there to do. So why would you not?
Well, I think in therapy, there can be, at least for me, I've had this idea sometimes of like this hierarchy, and I forget that it is this relationship. And I mean, I've been in therapy for, I don't know, like 6 or 7 years or something. But see, the way that you talked about your relationship with them, I have come to experience that with therapists. And I've like gone to many different therapists for different reasons. But I think we don't talk about how much it is a relationship. Like, it is an exchange. Your therapist can say a hard thing to you. It's for you to hold, you know, like, it's not always that they're going to make you feel good, but you'll know if it feels wrong. And like, I've had some therapists where I was like, okay, nope, this is not aligned. This is not good.
It's tricky though, because it feels like it is a relationship. 100% it is a relationship. And also it's a relationship that's unlike any other relationship. There's payment exchanged and they're there. I don't know. I had a really difficult time getting over the hump of like, I need my therapist to like me. You know, like, that's not the job that we're here to do. It's an interesting, I like the way, Sasha, that you talk about it. Maybe that's an approach for relationships outside of therapy too, just that forthrightness. But like, you seem to have a really clear understanding of the purpose of why you're there and the work that you want to do. And you seem really driven in making sure that you are getting that work done while you're there and not wasting both of your time by avoiding the elephant in the room or I don't know.
Well, thank you. That's very validating to hear, actually. Because when I entered therapy, it was really I was there because I had acne and I knew it was connected to my anxiety. And, you know, I could hide my anxiety, but I couldn't hide my acne. But it was interesting and quite revealing that there was more going on. I wasn't fully conscious of it at the time. But in the very first session, you know, the therapist was like, okay, so why are you here? And I told him, you know, about my anxiety. And I said, and I want to have a self-reckoning. And he laughed at me. And I was like, why are you laughing? And he said, because a lot of people, you know, will experience anxiety, but they don't always get to the self-reckoning part. So he was like, it's good. It's like, I'm glad you're here kind of thing. I think like a deeper part of me kind of knew there was stuff to address, that there's sort of the parts that were in charge of me at the time, to say the person driving the bus wasn't necessarily cognizant of the fact that I have deep work to do, but I did.
I love that the picture of that part of you knew that, even if you're right. Like, and I don't know which part that was for you, but there was a part of you that, even if that wasn't the bus driver, there was a part of me that was like, we need to be here. We have work to do.
And, you know, I mean, I'm a cartoonist and I did a graphic novel before starting therapy. And that graphic novel was kind of autobiographical. It was called Sky and Stereo. And it was about my own experience when I was 17 of taking LSD and not sleeping for a week and ending up in a psychiatric hospital for like 2 months, like for the entire summer. So I missed my exams. I missed like a whole year of my school life and I had to kind of go back and repeat. It was very devastating. And I kind of had written that story and done it as a graphic novel before I started therapy. So like 2015, that first one came out. And, you know, when you're an artist, you kind of like tap into deep things inside of you. And I think in that book, I knew that I'd been a little bit unwilling to engage with myself. Like I had recounted a story whilst keeping the feelings of it at arm's length. And so that book kind of gave me a bit of a midlife crisis as well, you know, because it's like, okay, there's something I'm not prepared to deal with here. And that was unconscious, but it was also like, I didn't know how to deal with it. I needed help. Like I needed a therapist to guide me because I was not equipped. I didn't have the tools. I didn't have the language. I didn't have the skills to kind of navigate that work on my own. And so, yeah, therapy was vitally important because that person is trained to do it and can hold compassion for you while you do it. Because I went in there very, you know, I'd had the kind of childhood where it's like, I had so many examples from my family of like what not to do. Like, I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be like her. I'm not going to be like him. I'm not going to be an addict. You know, I had this like this grit and determination, which is very American in a way, right? You know, very independent, like we can do this kind of people. And that was me too. And I went into therapy and my therapist said, are you very harsh on yourself? And I just like kind of crumbled, like, how the hell can you tell that? But it's like, yes, I was kind of holding myself together with like rigidity and like strictness and discipline and actually navigating that compassion. That was, oh my God, that made me fall apart and I needed someone to catch me. And that was my therapist. So, oh, Rebecca, that feels like it's moved you in a way. If you want to speak to that, if you're willing to, I'd love to. Hey.
Yeah, I mean, the way that you described that, I'm holding myself together with harshness and rigidity and, oh, I feel emotional that you saw that in me. That just resonates with me. I think the idea of self-compassion makes so much sense to me and sounds like the right way. And I find it very difficult to implement. And I have not done internal family systems therapy. Before reading your book, I thought I understood what it was, and I feel like there's a lot more to it than I knew. But there is a part of me, I have not reflected enough to know which part that is or where that comes from, but there is definitely a part of me that keeps us going and keeps us producing and keeps us good, again, air quotes, by being really harsh on myself and really critical. And nothing is going to be good enough. Because that's how we'll keep making good things, is if we tell ourselves that what you did is a mess and needs to be better. So yeah, thank you for seeing that in me. I don't even know if I know exactly how to talk about it, but I do know that my body responded to your description of that.
Thank you for having the courage and being willing to speak to it, even though you don't feel like you got it figured out. That's true courage, you know, and openness. I mean, yeah, there was a time in therapy. It was when the Harvey Weinstein stuff came out. So it was October 2017 or 18. And I just fell apart because everybody in my Facebook feed, all my female friends were sharing Me Too hashtags. And I had a Me Too story that was so weird that nobody could ever understand. And I felt so alienated and I just fell apart and I was having nightmares and PTSD symptoms. And I went into that therapy session and fell apart in front of my therapist, really for the first time. And he gave me kind of like, I keep thinking of it as the keys to the kingdom. I left that session able to understand like how I was going to free myself from this trauma that I'd carried and buried, like I hadn't even thought about for decades. And suddenly it was back and not, I couldn't avoid it. And he gave me the key, which is compassion. Like he said, you're a wonderful mother to your child, right? You love her fiercely and you can direct that same fierce compassion to yourself. And it was like, I can, and I could, and I did. And that was the beginning of it. After that therapy session, I think I got myself like a couple of, you know, composition books from the drugstore. And I got up at 5:30 in the morning, like all winter, like for a couple of months. And I just would write the whole story of my childhood from beginning to end. I was piecing it together. I was piecing all the things that had ever happened, like through pop songs I remembered. And I'd be like, oh, that pop song was on the radio. So what year was it? And I'd be like, oh, it would have been 1983. I was a detective. And I was also like this compassionate witness to this kid who was showing me her whole story from beginning to end. And when I finished it, therapy was never the same after that. I'd like kind of broken myself open. And it's like, okay, let's really do this now. I'm there for that little kid part of me too. So that was the difference. And that was the changing moment. And it was compassion. Compassion was the key. It's such like an obvious word, but when you actually take it in and experience it and live with it, you know, it's everything changes.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
Our goal for 2025 is to reach $900 on Patreon each month. This would cover our overhead so that we're not paying out of pocket each month to produce these episodes.
And just so you know where your money is going, the episodes are perfected by Amelia of Softer Sounds. She runs her studio with a rare humanity, and we feel so good partnering with her.
If you believe in these episodes, if you enjoy these conversations and want them to keep showing up in your feed, would you consider joining our Patreon?
You can join for $5 a month, which comes out to $1.25 per episode. Such a deal.
If you can't support financially, there are lots of ways that you can rally around this podcast, sharing a favorite episode with a friend or on social media, leaving a 5-star review. All of that really helps us keep this thing afloat.
Thanks. We love you so much. Back to the show.
The images in your book of you literally holding your younger parts up against your chest and like embracing were very moving to me to witness that tenderness and self-compassion that you're talking about sort of illustrated on the page of these, like holding yourself tenderly like that. I don't know what it is for me between the idea of it and wanting to implement and the difficulty of actually doing it. It sounds like for you, the process of writing that whole story and doing the detective work to tell your story was sort of the bridge to that for you, or would you describe it?
Oh, 100%. It was creativity. So in internal family systems therapy, to give you a tiny lesson, there are 8 qualities of our higher self. And the guy who invented the model or developed the model called Richard Schwartz, he discovered this model with his clients. You know, they would speak for parts of themselves and he would find parts of them and he'd be like, what part is that? And they would say, it's no part, it's just me. That's the real me. And so he found that his clients had a core self to them that was not damaged by trauma. It was there underneath all the trauma. And he identified it as self. And you know that you are in self when these qualities are available to you. And they all begin with C words, coincidentally, like courage, compassion, curiosity, connection, you know, all these qualities that can kind of come up. And so creativity is one of those C words. And so I feel that when I would write and draw, I was kind of A, getting curious about myself, and B, I was pulling in creativity. So it's like that self, which is kind of buried under your parts, I was grabbing hold of it and pulling it into my life because I was creating and being curious, you know? And so, and then the next thing you know is you're connecting to yourself and you're feeling compassion for yourself. So it's kind of like creativity is a way to, I don't want to say hack, but it's a way to hack yourself, you know? It's really there. It's genuinely there, but you are finding ways to just like pull it into being by your own willingness to engage with it, you know?
I'm jotting all of these things down. That's why I keep looking down. I'm like,
you know, we're recording this, right, Rebecca? You can you can listen to it.
That's right. This is my new morning practice. I'm just going to listen to Sasha talk me through this.
So funny. The piece about the like capital S self, I feel like when I found IFS, I was like, oh, that's why I had been drawing my parts, but I was just kind of like drawing them as like a feeling. And then I had experienced this feeling of like, not like, I don't know, being a hypocrite or like, because I would draw and write these things and I would post them on the internet and they were so compassionate. They were so curious. They were so connected. And I like was genuinely feeling them in the moment. But then later I would like the other parts would be there and I would be like harsh and critical and fearful. And sometimes I just like felt this like disparate before I had language for what I was doing. And then when I like found this, I was able to be like, oh, I can like speak this thing to myself. Like things I'm drawing and putting on the internet for other people, I could also turn. The work was the same, but the way that I was engaging with it felt different. And then I feel like I had more freedom to write about my other parts too and share them as also true. This bridges to what I want to talk about. I was looking through your therapy comics this morning and I found the one where you were talking to your daughter in 2020 when she was like scared during the pandemic that you might die. And I was reading through that and the way that you guided her and asked her to check in with her parts. And I was like, God, this is what I'm trying to do for Charlie. Like my most thing that I care about above all things is like, does he have emotional intelligence? Does he have connection to what he's feeling? Am I giving him the skills that I have been paying thousands of dollars to access in therapy in my 20s and 30s? So I'm really curious how going to IFS therapy in general, but how is this impacting your parenting? How are you bringing this into your parenting space?
It's really amazing to kind of look back on the memory of like the pandemic. And my daughter was 10 at the time and she's 15 now. And I can't parent her in the same way that I did back then. She sees me as preaching, lecturing, doesn't want to hear it anymore. It's like, here we go again, mom, with your breathing and your relaxation techniques and your clenching and your unclenching and all that. It's so what worked then doesn't work now. What I'm finding in myself is that she wants a lot of independence from me right now, you know, and that's natural. And it's hard. Like, I really miss my little kid, you know, but this is the order of things. Like, she is finding her way in the world and she's independent from me and she wants a lot of time to herself. And I can't be that teacher for her in that same way that I was. But just that being a sturdy adult, being that sturdy person for her, and just being curious and asking her. And it's like, you know, she doesn't want to tell me a bunch of stuff about her life. The things she does want to talk about. And it's just like kind of breaking that kind of veneer of like, oh, I don't know how to ask you about video games. But, you know, once she starts talking, she'll just talk. And it's like, okay, here we are together. And so, yeah, I get a lot from, do you know Dr. Becky Kennedy? Who is?
That's what I was thinking of while you said that. The sturdy pilot.
Just being that sturdy person. And it's like, you know, and I kind of like mess up all the time. And like, I made her cry recently because, you know, like I'm British and there's parts of me that want to go back to the UK and I've got good reasons for going back to the UK at some point. And, you know, she was tearful and she was like, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave like all my friends. And she had all these good reasons for like not going. And it was just like, okay, I feel terrible. I've made you feel sad. And yet we also need to sort of have honest conversations about what we do as a family. And, you know, you're 15, but everything you say is just as important as what we say. Do you know what I mean? You're not lesser because you're younger. And so just trying to navigate from that place. And I am parenting myself like all the time as I'm doing it because I mess up. Okay, so there's a therapist called Virginia Satir. And she was kind of like a proto IFS person. She was the mother of family systems therapy, right? And so her work was what Richard Schwartz based his work on. And I love her work so much because it teaches how to be big, compassionate, whole people, no matter what our backgrounds are. And one of the things she talks about is that we can come from a closed communication system, or we can come from like an open communication system in a family. And, you know, she kind of like shows you what a closed communication system looks like, where like one person is in charge, you don't challenge authority, you know, it's their way or the highway, you should be grateful, you shouldn't, you know, speak out, don't be rude, be seen and not heard, that kind of stuff. Or you can be an open family communication system, where you can actually like speak for like what you're feeling. You can kind of like say what you've done wrong and own it and fess up and build bridges and really kind of like learning about like open communication systems. It's like, you know, you can speak for what's not working, you know, and so you can kind of like change tack and you can change gear. So that's been really, really helpful to me. And I'm still figuring it out, but there are lots of great tools out there.
I feel like I want to listen to you talk more about parenting, especially with knowing the way that you bring compassion into all of this. So I kind of want to sit at your feet and hear you talk more about this. Because I, as we've already established, self-compassion does not come easily to me. And I was really interested in, and that shows up in my parenting a lot. And I was really interested in your memoir, this idea of legacy burden. You describe legacy burden as like three generations experiencing trauma at the same age, which was such a fascinating idea to me. And I don't know if there's anything like that in my family, but it does seem like there are like these patterns of anxiety and patterns of pain that I see. And I want so much to not pass that on to my son that I feel like I'm like relentlessly looking for it in my parenting. And I'm kind of always like, I will take an approach with him and then I'll be like, that was the wrong approach. And I will do another one and then another one in a way that I'm like, this is bananas. Like, this isn't helpful for anyone. And one more thing I'll add to that is that I also feel in my own family of origin, I believe with my whole heart that my parents absolutely did the best that they could. There was harm that was done that they were not even aware of. Anywhere. It was just not something that was on their radar. And I'm so worried about that for me. Like, what is the thing I'm not thinking about? And so I can just be like kind of relentless with myself in trying to protect him from me. I'm assuming it's not the same for you, but I am curious how you approach the like harm prevention or the inevitability, I think, in parenting is that we will in some ways hurt our kids or do some kind of harm. Like, no parent is perfect. So I guess I'm wondering how you lean into that or process that or approach that as a parent.
Okay, there's two things that you've said there. So I'm going to address the first one first, which is that I do explore legacy burdens in my memoir. And the legacy burden my therapist points out to me is the fact that at the age of 17 going on 18, me, my mother and my grandmother all experienced a kind of pretty significant trauma. So for me, that was being in a psychiatric hospital. That was on my 18th birthday. My mother was in a terrible car crash and my grandmother was World War II broke out like right after her 18th birthday. And so, you know, that this is kind of like an extreme situation. And I don't want people to think that, oh, it has to look like that in order to count as a legacy burden. That was so obvious to my therapist. Like, we need to look at this because there was something going on with you three when you were 17 going on 18. And for me, what it did was it opened a door to curiosity. So as I navigated my own system and my own parts and my own healing, I got really curious about, well, why was it like that? Why was my mom kind of absent when I was 13? Why did she become a Jehovah's Witness? She got really religious. And I got kind of curious about her story. And there's a part of me that is very much a detective and wants to piece things together. It's like, that's why she did that. This is why she did that. But I knew going into it that my mother, she'd suffered a sexual assault when she was 13. And then when I was 13, she kind of didn't want to be around me so much. You know, she was a workaholic. She didn't want to parent me. So I did my own cooking. I did my own laundry at that age. And she had joined a church. She joined the Jehovah's Witnesses like at that age too. So pretty extreme. So that was the legacy burden. The way I navigated it was like it started with curiosity and it became something else. It became compassion and fierce anger, not at my mother, but at the situation like around her. You know, for the first time ever, I would think about my mother's like sexual assault, not with a kind of like numbness or detachment, but for the first time, I was able to sort of get really angry about it and angry at the man who'd hurt my mom, who was, you know, who was a kid, and just the effect it had on me and just experiencing that huge kind of rage in therapy that was in this safe container, in a safe place with a therapist who was like, it's okay to be angry. Because I had never in my life been told before it's okay to be angry. You know, I come from a Jehovah's Witness family where you are mild and you are meek and you kind of like push all that down and we don't display negative emotions, right? So that was one part of it. The second part of it is who I am having come out of therapy is like, oh, I know I'm going to mess up constantly. And I do. I'm always making mistakes and there's no like fixing I can't fix myself to be the perfect mom, especially as the rules keep changing and the world gets more difficult and my kid keeps changing ages and doesn't want the same thing from me anymore, you know? And so, yeah, I don't know. It's like, I don't have an answer because I don't think there is one. We can just, you know, just model in ourselves like, okay, when I mess up, I want my daughter to know that, yeah, I kind of like messed up and this is what it looks like and this is what repair looks like. That's really the best we can do.
Yeah, the repair piece, like Dr. Becky talks about that too.
She's IFS informed, by the way.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
She's like Richard Schwartz gave, I think he did the intro to her book or he gave a quote for a book. But yeah, she's IFS informed, but she's not an IFS therapist. She just uses principles of it.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I could see that. But yes, I mean, she does talk a lot about repair. And I don't know, I wonder if part of it is modeling, like, I'm just listening to what you've been, I'm absorbing everything that you've said today and thinking, I wonder if part of it is like, practicing that self-compassion. I think the part of me that worries is it's that part of me that comes up that's like, if you're not hard on yourself, then you're gonna fall backwards and you're not gonna do a good job. And so you have to be hard on yourself and you have to be critical and vigilant so that you will be good. And I wonder if part of the work is in thinking about self-compassion as also an offering to my kid. I wonder if that's part of it for me. I don't know.
So one of the tenets of IFS therapy is that all parts are welcome and all parts are inherently good. They have good intentions for us, right? That part of you, which is so harsh, like I recognize it because I had that part too. And that part hasn't completely gone away. It's just changed its job title. You know, it's not a harsh boss anymore. It's a bit of a taskmaster at times, but it's like a compassionate one. It's like a boss that I actually enjoy being with who will bring donuts and make my work day nice. But I'm still really driven. Like I've got stuff that I want to do in this life, right? And so that taskmaster part's not gone away. She's just shifted. She's got more self-energy too. And our parts can do that. Our parts can kind of absorb self-energy. And I think there was one more thing, if it's okay to circle back to the legacy burdens. I was carrying around this big, difficult story and this big, difficult family history. And it always felt like an unexploded bomb or something that I was carrying around. I had to be very careful around not to jostle or disturb or accidentally trigger or activate, right? And my family story no longer feels like an unexploded World War II bomb. It feels like this story, which actually lives in me. And like the world has gotten really bad right now. And I don't feel terror as I did in 2016, because it's like my grandmother lived through World War II. Like she got through it. She lived through it. Like her strength is actually part of my strength now. Like I feel her, like she's kind of online and accessible to me, even though she's dead. And even though we didn't have a relationship before she died, I have made her story into something that belongs to me. And it's a story that I can give to my kid and say, look, this is where you come from. This is our family story. Like, look how much courage and tenacity is there. And I can give her that story without giving her my difficult emotions around it. Like, we don't talk about that. You know, this is a secret. That's private. That doesn't matter. Like, all that stuff has, like, been dealt with, you know? So I can just give her the core of, like, look at our people, you know? Look at what we did. Look at how we got here, you know? And I think that's really valuable. Like, I have family photographs now, and I've visited graves in England of people who are no longer, like, the silent dead. Their stories are kind of, like, alive for me, you know? And that's a real gift.
Yeah. And to give your kid too, it's a gift to both of you. Yeah.
She didn't appreciate being dragged around to graveyards like on our last trip to the UK. Like, this is your great, great grandmother. She's like, whatever. Can we please go somewhere where it's not raining? You know? But one day she might appreciate it.
Yes. To know those stories. Yes.
I would love to like get together with the two of you and just talk about your books as well, because they have both like taught me things and spoken to me on so many different levels. Yeah, I mean, Caitlin, I have so many questions for you about fundamentalist Christianity, which is something I'm very, very interested in. And Rebecca, your book is just, I'm still sitting with it and still examining so many parts of me that have come up reading it. You know, I talked about a closed family system, and I actually grew up with a stepdad who had a disability that was not talked about, was not addressed, and it felt very taboo. And I felt a lot of shame about having to sort of navigate, you know, and just realizing that has really fed into my ableism and my own lens of like how I sort of see disability and like the constriction I feel when it's like, oh, I mustn't do the wrong thing. I mustn't say the wrong thing, you know? So thank you. I mean, if we could do a part two and just talk about your work, I'd love that.
I think that like what you've named there has been really common for parents with disabilities in the past. And I do think that something that feels really important to me is helping parents process that internalized ableism in the way that they show up to their families and how that informs their relationships with their kids. Because I've heard other people with similar stories. There can be so much shame. And the next part of that is like silence around that shame. And that sort of becomes this vortex. And I think it's very easy for all of us to interpret that as disability is this very bad thing that has ruined everything. And so I think it makes a lot of sense how that happens. And I guess it just feels important to be able to open up the doors and look at it together and have space to process. And I think stories for disabled parents to see themselves in and be able to have something to imagine for themselves, or like potential parents, right? Like what this could look like. I don't know. I obviously, there's so much I don't know about your stepdad and what that relationship was like, but I have heard just that pattern of shame and silence and how that gets interpreted as a kid.
And it's kind of making me think how sharing our stories is such an act of generosity, because it gives them permission to kind of like think about things that they didn't know how to think about before. And, you know, to sort of like examine themselves. I feel like one way I'm going to get through the next 4 years under the next Trump administration is I'm just going to keep leaning into like learning, because when I learn, I'm kind of not inert. I'm not apathetic. I'm not stagnant. You know, I'm still growing when I'm learning. And so, yeah, this is my new edge for the next 4 years. I'm going to keep opening new doors, you know?
Yeah. I love that as a response to the heaviness.
One thing that I was struck again by as I was looking back through stuff this morning is how you are integrating your work in parts therapy in your day-to-day life, how often you're like checking in and having conversations with them, which I think is the beauty of IFS, is that you can do that on your own. You don't have to be in the office to like continue that work. What I'm asking is like, how do you remember to pause? And beyond that, not just remembering to pause to do the work, but how do you actually get yourself to do it? I like have all these tools and resources at my disposal. I'm well resourced. And for me, the hardest part is like doing the resource, you know, like pausing. I know the breathwork techniques. I know how to talk to my parts. I know what works. And this is probably a part that I need to work with, but that like blocks me where I'm like, oh, you don't have time. This is silly. If you just had your shit together, you wouldn't have to pause so much to take care of yourself. So I was wondering, how are you doing that? How are you getting yourself to pause? Do you have built-in rituals?
Train rides.
Yeah, train rides.
Well, yeah, I don't have the train rides anymore. Well, one thing I would say is like, kind of like be compassionate to yourself, because you two have like younger kiddos and they need you so much more when they're little, and there is less time for yourself. So I kind of appreciate that. And what we'll say is, I mean, I have more time now that my kid is 15. I have a lot more freedom. But I do. I have pretty good morning routine. So I do like a little bit of like exercise and yoga and breathing in the morning. And that is non-negotiable. So I kind of like do that most days. And that just gives me like a baseline of like feeling kind of open to myself. I think another thing that has kind of developed for me is that now I've had the experience of feeling so much freer and lighter. Like when I feel parts kind of clouding me, it's kind of a little bit intolerable. It's like, I hate this feeling. I don't want to feel like this. So that's a motivation just to kind of like feel better and give myself a little space. There is a spiritual teacher / IFS teacher called Ralph De La Rosa. He deals a lot with like Buddhist psychology, the integration of IFS. And I've really gotten a lot from his work. And he talks about how having an open heart or having a closed heart, that's the essence of the Buddhist Dharma, right? And when you have a closed heart, you know, just the world feels so different. And I know from IFS that you can kind of like open your heart, by which I mean bring compassion out. So my heart doesn't feel kind of like crusted, or, you know, like I don't feel numb. And there are kind of like in IFS, it offers you a couple of ways to kind of get to having an open heart. One is to get to identify the parts of yourself and see if they will step back and give you some space. And then the other way is that you can kind of like hack it and just like kind of like pull it in. And I've talked about how writing and drawing and using my creativity are some ways to hack it. But there's also other ways, like just going out in nature or connecting with people. I've gotten really good at asking myself, like, what is it I need right now from self to feel better? Like, what do I need? What's missing in me right now? And I just go through that little circle of C's. Like, it's like one of those, you know, game show wheels that you can kind of like spin, like what's the sea going to land on? Is it connection? Do I need to like talk to a friend or talk to my husband? Or do I need to just get curious and do a little bit of IFS work? Or do I need, you know, is it some compassion? I need a hug, or like, what do I need? And so just that has become kind of second nature to me now, just like checking in, like, what do I need from self? And can I hack it? Can I pull it in? Or do I need to ask my parts to step back and give me some space? Both ways have a lot of validity. Like this morning, like I wasn't feeling it. And so instead of having a shower, I had a bath and it felt like the height of luxury. But that saltwater bath was just like, oh, this is actually physically what I needed. I needed some somatic, you know, kind of like input. And so, yeah, it's okay to be really kind of curious about yourself, you know, and I feel like, especially as females, like when we're born female, we're really taught to serve other people and, you know, kind of people please. And it's a trauma response too. But you know, like when you turn that people pleasing towards yourself and it's like, okay, I'm really going to nurture myself. I'm really going to look after myself. It's not selfish because it's just like the baseline of like, I can do things in the world now. I can tend to other people because I'm really like looking after myself. That makes sense.
It does make sense because Sasha, I feel like witnessing you and all of these tools that you have is helping us, like being near that, your book, like it's interesting to see how something that was really caring for yourself is actively caring for us in this moment, for your readers. And one thing that strikes me is that you said at the beginning that you said that one of the reasons you went to therapy is that you didn't have the tools. And my God, you have the tools now.
Well, thank you.
I just am listening to all of these different tools and strategies and like this framework that you have that just feels really sturdy and sustainable. Also really beautiful because we get to sort of bask in and bear witness to the creativity that's come of it. So
self-energy is inherent in all of us. We all have like our own gifts and it's like this renewable energy source. And sometimes it feels depleted, but there are ways to kind of find it again. It's like the sun. It's not going to go out, you know, at least not for a couple of billion years.
We have time.
Yeah, we have time. And one of the things I would say is that the whole reason for doing this book in a way was that I look around the world and I see people, you know, acting in a cruel way, like voting for cruelty. And like, where does that come from? And I really think it comes from trauma, from unaddressed, unhealed trauma, and from how people are treated. I have this conviction, you know, the world needs therapy and it needs to be out there. And I know it's a privilege and I know not everyone can go to therapy and spend the time and do the work. But if the tools from therapy can be out in the world and can kind of like reach people and they can become part of what we give to our kids and part of the culture, I think we can kind of evolve, you know? Yeah, they should become a knowledge. I had to pay a lot of money at the age of 40 to like learn all this stuff, but someone could have taught it to me when I was 7 and like how amazing would that have been, you know? So thank you for giving me this space as well, because this has just been a magical conversation for me. I have so many more questions for the both of you. It feels wonderful to sort of find that connection and other people doing their own work to shine their own light and sort of bring that healing in the world that they want to see, you know, it just is wonderful.
I have my notes. I feel like I have so much I want to keep processing from this conversation. And thank you for taking the time to talk with us. But I feel like you've had such a generous presence in this conversation to see both of us and how we're processing all of this too. So thank you for that offering. I feel very seen by you. So.
And likewise, I mean, you two have like read my work so closely of like parts of me are like, ah, so thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, let's hang out in real life. And I feel like there are many more conversations for us to have in this space as well.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for being here. We love you.
Bye.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by Amelia of Softer Sounds.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.